From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. 7%. That is how much coronavirus cases have increased in the past week, according to CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. Here she is today at a White House briefing.
As the trends and data have been indicating, cases are increasing nationally, and we are seeing this occur predominantly in younger adults. This is why you've heard me so clearly share my concern. We know that these increases are due, in part, to more highly transmissible variants, which we are very closely monitoring.
Dr. Walensky also applauded the vaccine effort and the record 4 million doses administered on Saturday. For more now, let's bring in Dr. Megan Ranney. She's an emergency physician at Brown University and the director of the Brown Lifespan Center for Digital Health. Welcome, doctor. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're hearing great news on the vaccine front, but bad news, it seems, about an increase of cases. Dr. Michael Osterholm told Meet the Press over the weekend that we are in a, quote, Category 5 hurricane, and he expects huge increases globally in the next couple of weeks. To your mind, doctor, are we headed for a fourth surge here?
It's a little early to tell here in the United States. We're certainly seeing increasing numbers. We continue to be in this race between the novel variants, particularly that B.1.1.7 variant that was first identified in Britain, and the vaccines. And really what happens next is up to us. If we keep wearing masks in public, if we keep following those same basic public health suggestions or rules, we can avert a significant surge. We are going to see some increases in numbers no matter what. But if we throw masks to the wind, we will be heading into a fourth surge.
So tell us more about these variants that you mentioned. They're being reported in Massachusetts, Florida, Alaska, and many other states. How widespread are they, and how much are they really driving these case increases?
So it's tough to know with certainty how widespread the variants are because we simply weren't doing a lot of sequencing of the genomes of COVID-19 cases up until very recently. But it seems that particularly that B.1.1.7 variant is increasing in prevalence. So more and more of the cases that we are sequencing are coming back positive for the B.1.1.7 variant. As a reminder, that's the one that took Europe, originally the UK and then the rest of Europe, by storm and has driven the surge there over the last couple of months. We know it's quite prevalent in Florida, in Massachusetts, and elsewhere. And it is more transmissible, which means it's easier to catch. It spreads more easily. Why those masks are so, so important right now. There are also a bunch of other variants out there, Jane, which are giving equal, if not more, concern to the public health community because some of those other variants might be more resistant to the vaccine. The vaccines that are currently out there work very well against B.1.1.7, but might not work as well against some of the other new variants that we're identifying. Mm.
We heard Dr. Walensky talk about the increase in cases among young adults. Doctor, what should we know about this increase in infections among younger people?
You know, I think that younger folks, first of all, are least likely to have been vaccinated, so they don't have the protection of the vaccine, which is just, again, I can't say it enough. It's almost magical in how well it works. The second thing is that they're more likely to be out and about, going to restaurants and bars. It has been really tough on young people to stay home for the past year. The third thing is that being young does not protect you. As an ER doc, I can tell you I've admitted a bunch of 30 and 40-year-olds to the intensive care unit at my hospital. And so I wish that folks wouldn't feel that they're protected simply because they are young. Mm-hmm.
So there's an increase in young people being infected, but CDC Director Walensky also said that total deaths from the virus are down right now. So how do you see those numbers, a sort of lagging indicator?
So it's two parts. One is, yes, it's a lagging indicator. We know that we don't see deaths until somewhere between 2 and 4 weeks after someone has been infected. So I would expect that deaths will start to increase over the next couple of weeks. But the other part is that we know that older folks are more likely to die. And we have done a wonderful job of vaccinating people who are in nursing homes, people who are age 75 plus. And we're starting to see increasing numbers of vaccines among the age 65 plus. I think that's also helping to drive down the total number of deaths.
Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency room physician at Brown University and director of the Brown Lifespan Center for Digital Health, giving us an update today on COVID-19. Doctor, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
In Florida today, the race is on to prevent a failing reservoir from sending a wall of toxic water into a local neighborhood. Here's Governor Ron DeSantis at a news conference south of Tampa yesterday.
What we're looking at now is trying to prevent and respond to, if need be, a real catastrophic flood situation.
The reservoir holds millions of gallons of water tainted with phosphorus. It is a byproduct of fertilizer production. Hundreds of homes within a mile of the plant at Piney Point have been ordered to evacuate. Joining us now is Matt Pasek. He's a professor of geoscience at the University of South Florida in Tampa. Matt, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you, too.
And people like you have been keeping an eye on this reservoir for years. I understand it was built in the 1960s, but has been inactive for about two decades. Explain what the reservoir is used for and what's happening with it.
Right. So this thing is sculpted out of a solid waste product of the phosphate mining industry, and it is full of fluid that kind of got left over from the processing of the phosphate ore to make phosphate fertilizer, and is now full of phosphate fertilizer. It's a sort of elevated pond.
And what's in that water? Because as you say, this is connected to the fertilizer industry, which makes me think chemicals.
Right. The majority of the water, as far as the sort of compounds that are a little bit not normal or sort of out of whack from sort of environmental water, include a fair bit of phosphorus and a fair bit of nitrogen. There's a couple other elements that are in there as well that are a result of the mining process, but those are by far the most abundant out of the ordinary elements.
Well, over the weekend, Governor DeSantis said that the water is not radioactive. Why are we talking about that? And do you agree?
So that is a good question. So the ore that phosphate is extracted from is mildly radioactive, and the water that is sort of the waste product of this is also mildly radioactive. But radioactive has a whole big range of values, and to put it in perspective, this one's more radioactive than bananas, but not that many bananas. It's about 20 bananas worth of radioactivity.
Okay, so in terms of danger?
Not much in terms of digestive danger, on at least a short term for certain.
Oh, okay. Well, there are a few problems here that we should get into. One is the urgent problem for people who live nearby this thing if it were to fail. It's a lot of water that's in this pond. How dangerous is that threat as far as you can tell?
That is potentially the biggest issue in the immediate term. So the problem with this pond is it is the highest point nearby. Florida is a very flat state. And so were this pond to rupture, there is a lot of water that could come gushing out in a very short amount of time. If it were to all spread out over about a square mile, it would cover the entire area with about a yard of water.
All right. Well, the other issue is longer term. And the question is, what would releasing this phosphorus water into the environment do to the ecosystem? Because officials are now pumping it out to relieve the pressure on the walls of this reservoir. How concerned are you about that?
That is definitely the more medium-term issue and could have a very big impact. For the same reasons that phosphorus is the fertilizer, it's also a nutrient that causes things like algal blooms. And algal blooms are when algae suddenly is allowed to reproduce uncontrollably, and as a result will cause greening of the water and often causes the subsurface to become poor in oxygen. As a result, fish start to die, and the water starts to smell bad. The ecosystem kind of gets pretty well wrecked, at least in the immediate zone where this happens on the month-long time scale. And potentially we may get a red tide due to the influx of phosphorus as well. And that is of concern because that can make fish and other food that you can extract from the ocean toxic.
All right, well, let's take a step back here. What questions does this problem raise about the process of making fertilizer? As we said, this reservoir has been inactive for years. I mean, was this water just going to sit there forever until something happened?
That is a fantastic question that is sort of the generational problem of mining. Mining generates waste, but we use, and in the case of phosphorus, this is, you know, an important element that is used in agriculture. And yes, what do we do with it? This is a substance that is hard to get rid of because it's radioactive. The solid is, at least. The water is toxic. And most of the time what they do is they'll try to flush in something like seawater. And seawater helps kind of make it a little bit more mild, but it doesn't fix the problem. And what most of the time people will do is just wait for it to kind of naturally equilibrate with the environment. That has not happened and does not happen on even decadal timescales, apparently.
Makes me wonder how common these plants are in the U.S. and also in Florida.
Exactly. There's over 20 in the state of Florida. Now, Florida is the producer of 70% of all of the United States phosphate, but another 20 are kind of situated outside of the state of Florida, 20 to 30 beyond the state of Florida. So these things are common. Mine waste in general is common, and is a problem that we need to do a bit better job focusing on and considering.
Matt Pasek is a professor of geoscience at the University of South Florida in Tampa. We'll keep an eye on this story for sure. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you, too. Appreciate it.
How would you respond in the face of near certain death? It's almost impossible to know, but in the 1940s, a group of young Jewish women living in the ghettos of Poland reacted to Hitler's murderous campaign with unfathomable courage. Judy Battalion's new book, The Light of Days, tells the story of women resistance fighters who smuggled weapons, assassinated Nazis, and sabotaged German supply lines. Some of the women survived. Judy Battalion joins us now. Welcome.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Many people are familiar with the death camps where millions of Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, but your book focuses primarily on the resistance that happened inside the ghettos where many of the Jews were sent before they ever reached those camps. What was life like in the ghettos of Poland?
Oh, life in the ghettos of Poland was truly torturous. They were extremely, extremely crowded. You could have several families living in one room. People had no personal space at all. There was a real dearth of food. Many of the testimonies and memoirs I read speak of the horrible illnesses and lice. It was a very physically uncomfortable existence. People in the ghettos also had no information. They were not allowed radios. They were not allowed newspapers. So people lived in great fear.
So within that existence, how did these women organize a resistance?
Many of the women that I write about were part of organized groups before being ghettoized. And these youth movements were almost substitute families. So when Jews were ghettoized, they were with members of their youth movements. They were with their comrades, as they called them, their fellows, their peers. And so there were already strong connections and a sort of pre-existing social organization for the young Jews who I write about in my book. And a big role of the women in the underground was to disguise themselves as being non-Jewish, and at risk to their lives, they slipped in and out of ghettos and they obtained information. They connected the ghettos to each other. They called each other the radio. They were the communications. That was an early form of the underground work that they did.
They also smuggled weapons.
They smuggled weapons, ammunition. They smuggled dynamite in their undergarments. They smuggled fake IDs, money, medication. They smuggled people. They took people out of slave labor camps and ghettos and brought them to the forest.
It's just amazing that they were able to do what they did. And part of the reason I think they were successful is because they were women and because they were young. Is that right?
Absolutely. A big part of being able to be an underground operative was you had to leave the ghetto. And to do that, you had to pass as Catholic Poles. And this was easier for women in a number of respects. Women were not circumcised, so they didn't have a physical marker of their Jewishness on their bodies like men did. In Nazi-occupied Poland, the pants drop test was a thing. If someone suspected a man of being Jewish, they ordered him to drop his pants. And so women didn't have to be afraid of that as well. Women in the 1930s, when these women who I write about were growing up, school was mandatory, but often families sent their sons to Jewish schools, to private schools, and they sent their daughters to Polish public schools. And because of that, many women were more acculturated. They were more assimilated. They were familiar with Catholic customs, behaviors, gestures, and very important at the time, they spoke Polish, they always say in their memoir, like a Pole, not with, as they called it, the creaky Yiddish accent. Wow. And so they were much, much better able to disguise themselves.
Well, they had no military training. They didn't know how to use a gun for the most part, certainly not a grenade. And yet they learned. I want to read this passage from your book. It says, "Comrades produced brass knuckles and daggers, studied chemistry and created bombs, grenades, and bottles filled with explosive materials. They used pipes, coal powder, and sugar. As their skills grew, their homemade bombs became better than the ones they bought." An important chapter in the book is about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943. Tell me about that.
The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising is the largest urban uprising, certainly among the Jews, against the Nazis. It was organized by youth movements who finally came together. There were a number of different youth movements, and they had different priorities and different ideas about how to resist. But it ended up being about 750 young Jews, ages, I'd say about 17 through 25. About a third of them were women. And when the Nazis came to liquidate the Warsaw Ghetto, they fought back. They flung Molotov cocktails. They bombed tanks. Their women's stories of them, you know, climbing to a roof of a low-rise building in the ghetto and her hands shaking as she lights a match and starts flinging this explosive. And she hears the Germans crying in shock. A Frau kämpft, a Frau kämpft. A woman is fighting. And these Jews kept off the Nazi liquidation. They pushed them back for some weeks.
How many did they kill?
That number, I don't know. You know, these were guerrilla groups working in utter, utter secrecy. They didn't have files. So I don't know that number.
You know what? It almost doesn't matter, does it? Because at one point you describe the joy of revenge these people felt as intoxicating. And many of the women were shocked that they even survived.
They didn't expect to survive. They assumed they would be killed. How could they not be killed? They're fighting brigades and troops and tanks of Nazis. These are starving Jewish teenagers. They, in fact, did not make survival plans. This became actually a bit of an issue in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. They hadn't set up bunkers for themselves to go to. They hadn't set up, they didn't have food. They didn't have supplies. They assumed they were going to be killed.
It wasn't a total victory, though, was it? Because the retaliation from the Nazis was fierce.
After a couple of weeks, they burnt down the entire ghetto, and the Jews who weren't killed outright by Nazi gunfire were enveloped in fire. I mean, one of the fighters who I write about, Zivia Lebetkin, she was a leader in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. She said, we were prepared to fight Nazis. We weren't prepared to fight fire. And many of them simply choked to death. They died in the fire.
Throughout the course of the war, many of the women you wrote about died, but others survived and miraculously made it out of the country and eventually to what was then Palestine, now Israel. What became of them once the war ended?
Everyone dealt with their experience in a different way. Some people became involved as Holocaust teachers and educators and scholars, and very involved in survivor communities, and others completely left their past, really had to start afresh in order to move on.
Because they had guilt or trauma?
So many of the people I'm writing about, when the war ended, they were in their early 20s. They had the rest of their lives in front of them. They had missed their, what I was thinking of as their college years. That's what the war was. And now they were adults, and they'd lost their everything, their families, their time to train for a career even. And for some of them, the need to start afresh was a way of coping, a way of moving past that. And many of them felt, I write about women, and many of them felt a really almost a cosmic sense of duty to create a new generation of Jewish people. And they had children. And it was also very important for many of them to raise their children, to try to be happy and normal. And because of that, too, many of them left their pasts behind, or attempted to, for some decades.
This book is so well-researched, and I know it took you a very long time to go from concept to publication. In that time, what did these women teach you as you got to know them through history? And what do they have to teach us about resistance?
These women taught me. I mean, these women, I feel very inspired by their bravado and their courage and their conviction. I've thought about this, and many, I've spoken to their families too, and I think many of them were women who had a great sense of instinct. They really trusted their gut. They were confident in their own sense. What my central character, Renya, her son told me in passing, sort of, you know, when she crossed the street, she wasn't someone who looked left and right and left. She just crossed the street. And I think a lot of these women were like that. They just crossed the street. They did what they had to do. They didn't second guess. I'm a second guesser. So I'm very drawn to those who can just cross the street.
Well, the book is just amazing. That's so, so enlightening. Thank you. Judy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Judy Battalion's book is The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about movies, music, and more, like why The Great Pottery Throwdown is a comforting binge watch, and a look back at some of Chadwick Boseman's essential performances. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Georgia's new hate crimes law is about to be put to its first test. The law provides for longer prison sentences for those convicted of a crime motivated by hate based on race, religion, gender, or sexual orientation. The man charged with targeting Asian massage businesses in the Atlanta area recently already faces the state's stiffest penalty, death by lethal injection. There's nothing to add to that sentence, but death penalty or not, some say the hate crime label needs to be applied. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Ellen Eldred reports.
Six of the eight people killed in the spa shootings were women of Asian descent, and whether or not their deaths are legally called hate crimes matters to a community already concerned about a rise in anti-Asian hate during the pandemic. So says BJ Peck, a former U.S. District Attorney representing the family of one of the spa shooting victims. And as a Korean American, he says this case is personal.
I think it's the main reason why the hate crime statute was necessary in the case to deter future conduct, and the symbolic importance and the message to send to the Asian American community that they are protected and this type of conduct would be discouraged going forward as well.
During an early press conference, many people took offense at the way the suspect's confession was portrayed. Officials were criticized for taking his word that the shootings were motivated by an addiction to sex that he wanted to, quote, eliminate. State Representative B. Nguyen stood with four other Asian American lawmakers to affirm that regardless of race, targeting women is still a hate crime.
The perpetrator did say he was targeting these establishments because of a sex addiction, and the correlation is he was eliminating the sex workers in these places. That is a gender-based crime. And so under the hate crimes law that was passed, this would still be a hate crime.
While filling out an initial incident report, a Cherokee County deputy checked a box for hate crime and wrote anti-gender female. The sheriff's office says the report was later changed to say motivation unknown because one of the four victims in the Cherokee County attack was a man. Michael Moore is a former U.S. attorney who served the Middle District of Georgia. He says that's just sloppy police work.
You take that and then some of the comments made that are now in the public record about, you know, how they described the suspects and such. I think that's a goldmine for people to make court challenges.
He means challenges to whatever charges are brought against the suspect. Joyette Holmes is the former Cobb County District Attorney in charge of the prosecution of the men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery. Arbery's death inspired Georgia's hate crimes law. While hate crime charges may not change the penalty the suspect in the spa killings might face, Holmes says they still matter to activists and people of color who have been battling racism for generations.
So even where you don't find a legal path forward to where it seems like it makes sense if somebody's already being sentenced to death, I do think that there is a heavy societal push forward and movement for, you know, hopefully for within our generation and our time, but certainly for those generations to come, so that in the history books, they're not talking about the same things that we're talking about today.
The prosecutors in Fulton and Cherokee counties have not said when or if they may add hate crime charges to 8 total murder charges against the suspect in the spa shootings. For Here and Now, I'm Ellen Eldridge in Atlanta.
Does the news seem overwhelmingly negative these days? Well, economics professor Bruce Sasserdoe thought the same thing. He felt that news coverage, especially of the coronavirus pandemic, was often more negative than what scientists or actual data suggested. So he and 2 colleagues compiled all the COVID coverage from the major networks and analyzed it using a social science technique. Bruce Sasserdoe joins us now. He's professor of economics at Dartmouth and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thanks very much, Jane. It's great to be on the show.
So what prompted you to dig into media coverage of the pandemic in the first place?
You know, like almost all of your listeners, I was stuck at home and watching a lot of news and finding it more and more depressing. And the more I watched, the more it hit me that they were covering things in the worst possible way, and that even when cases were dropping, they were talking about record case numbers and such. And at first I thought I was going crazy and misreading the numbers, but then I started to think, oh, maybe they're covering this in a rather negative light.
So help us understand how you conducted your research then. Explain the social science technique you used to determine whether news coverage was negative, positive, or neutral.
In short, we grabbed the text of tens of thousands of articles about COVID from all kinds of different sources. And the simplest technique we used is to take existing dictionaries of negative and positive words and merge those on there and count them up and look at the fraction of words that are positive versus negative.
So let's dig into some of your findings then. You found that news coverage of the pandemic in the United States was more negative than in international news outlets or in scientific journals. So in those thousands and tens of thousands of articles, what stood out about U.S. media in particular?
Well, it's shockingly negative. It's amazing how strong the finding is. You can look in subsamples, different periods of time, different topics. And, you know, you find that when we classify articles as positive or negative, something like over 90% of articles from the U.S. major media are negative versus closer to 50% to 60% for international major media. So just very, very different.
Well, and notably, the coverage was negative in media outlets with liberal audiences like MSNBC and in conservative audiences like Fox News.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, it's incredible just the overwhelming negativity of it. And, you know, Fox, as we've dug into this in a more nuanced way, it's true that Fox's brand of negativity can be different than, say, CNN's, but they both tilt very much negative.
So give us an example of a time during the pandemic when the coverage was more negative than positive.
Even in, say, May and early June, when cases were trending down, you still had a lot of outlets saying, instead of talking about the fact that cases were dropping, they're saying, oh, records are being set in this state and that state, or the cumulative death toll is this. Of course, the cumulative can only go up, it can't go down. There, you know, when there was all this fantastically great news about vaccine approvals, the networks would then quickly jump to things like, well, there were these side effects from people who took it, or, oh, there's these new variants out there, and maybe the vaccines aren't going to work against those variants.
So when COVID cases were rising in the U.S., news coverage emphasized the increase. When they were falling, coverage focused on places where cases were rising. And when vaccine research began showing positive results, the coverage downplayed it.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. When the first tests from the AstraZeneca vaccine became available, the researchers are like, hey, look, it's creating all these large number of antibodies in the test subjects. And so the media managed to find some medical experts to say, well, you know, of course, antibodies aren't the be all and end all. And just because it's creating antibodies doesn't mean that we should have any confidence that it's going to give you protection against the virus. You know, so really not if odd, I would say unnecessary caveats or overly negative caveats and interpretations.
So you and your co-authors say that you aren't entirely sure why coverage in the U.S. has been so negative throughout the pandemic. But one idea is that American media outlets could be responding to consumer demand, what people want. Explain that, Professor.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of the saddest part of the whole tale, which is that, you know, we have no one to blame but ourselves. If you look at the most popular articles and whether you use that by, say, the most viewed articles on the New York Times or the most shared articles, overwhelmingly, people tend to view the more negative articles. So even within the set of major media articles, people tend to gravitate towards the most negative stuff. It's not exclusively so. People do occasionally share and view positive articles, but people tend to gravitate towards the negative. And we think that the American media is just very good at giving people what they want.
And just to be clear, you're not saying that journalists are reporting things that are untrue. You're just saying that by emphasizing the negative, the media isn't giving the full picture.
We're not deeply looking for misreporting, but we don't have any specific examples of misreporting and giving false information. And fundamentally, we don't think that the major American media is in the business of reporting fake news, but we think they are in the business of reporting rather negative news and emphasizing the negative news.
So what do you hope journalists can learn from your research as we continue to cover this crisis?
So I'm hoping, you know, my co-authors and I are hoping that journalists will try to bring balance to their stories. So if they're going to report, for example, that someone died after receiving a vaccine, that it'll be like, but of course, these like 100 million people, got it and were perfectly fine and none of them got the virus. Or if someone gets COVID twice, there'll be some emphasis on the fact that, but that seems to be really rare. And these other studies show that, you know, this fraction of people were protected and had large amount of antibodies. So bringing context, you know, putting these facts in context, essentially.
That is Dartmouth economics professor Bruce Sasserdoe. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. I really appreciate the time.
And now we turn to Alaska, where there are not a lot of maternity wards in remote towns and villages. That can make pregnancy challenging in a normal year. In a pandemic, it's even more complicated. Claire Strempel from member station KTOO in Juneau reports on one woman who spent months far away from home to keep her community safe in this story, which originally aired on Morning Edition.
St. Paul Island is in the middle of the Bering Sea, 800 miles from the nearest hospital. There is a clinic on the island, so most prenatal appointments happen there. Pregnant people usually visit Anchorage only a few times before they move to the city about a month before their due date.
That's typically what's done here, but that's not the story that I have.
Kara Lestenkoff-Mendrigan is part of the indigenous Yunungan community that lives on the island. She and her boyfriend found out she was pregnant with twins.
Then I had the doctor come in and tell me all these things that could potentially go wrong.
Pregnant women are already at higher risk for serious illness due to COVID-19. And the doctor told her twins are also considered a high-risk pregnancy.
And that after 16 weeks, I would need to travel out to Anchorage every 2 weeks for appointments. My jaw dropped.
Her island stayed safe while case counts began to rise in Anchorage, where she was traveling for checkups. But that travel started to feel like a gamble. She didn't want to get sick or be the one who brought COVID-19 back from the city. Eventually, doctors at Alaska Native Medical Center advised that she stay in Anchorage.
I was going to have to go to COVIDville and possibly contract the infection.
As a health aide, she had seen colds and flus spread across her small island like wildfire.
So we decided that we were going to leave and just stay out in Anchorage until it was time to deliver.
We really need to start working on how do we support these moms as best we can because they're not delivering near their families.
Pediatrician Matt Hirschfeld leads maternal child health services at Alaska Native Medical Center.
They're not delivering with their aunties and grandmas and, you know, everybody around them.
That separation from home and family is hard, but Hirschfeld says it's done for a good reason.
Back in the 80s and before, Alaska had one of the highest neonatal mortality rates, which is defined as kids who die before the first 30 days in the country.
Hirschfeld says the transition to hospital births correlates to a 75% drop in infant mortality over the last few decades. Hospital housing does have communal kitchens and play areas for families to gather when they're away from home. But COVID-19 shut all that down. The pandemic has put a spotlight on the hardships of separation and isolation during pregnancy.
Kind of just a blur, but we were there for a long time.
For months, Kara Lestenkoff-Mendrigan and her boyfriend only left their small room for medical appointments. She says she was grateful her partner was there. Many women make the trip alone.
We spent our days, you know, keeping to ourselves, stayed in our room, watched a lot of Netflix, and enjoyed the fast internet.
When Kara, her partner, and the twins got home, they hadn't seen their families in 4 months. She says it's a story the twins will hear for the rest of their lives. For NPR News, I'm Claire Strimple.
McDonald traps, heaves, can't hit, that is it! Stanford survives again!
It was a thrilling conclusion to the NCAA women's tournament last night. The Stanford Cardinal beat back the Arizona Wildcats. The one-point victory gave Stanford a national title for the first time in 29 years. And tonight, the Gonzaga Bulldogs are up against the Baylor Bears for the men's title. Gonzaga is one game away from a perfect season. It would be the first time since the Indiana Hoosiers went undefeated in 1976. Let's bring in Andrea Adelson. She's a senior writer at ESPN. Andrea, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, these games are always tough on the stomach, but that one last night between Arizona and Stanford, a heartbreaker for the Wildcats. What were your highlights from that game?
The end was the biggest highlight, and I know as fans and folks watching at home, their hearts were racing. As a sports writer and a sports fan, my heart was racing because I wanted to see how this was all going to end. You had this incredible story of the underdog Arizona Wildcats. Nobody expected them to be there. And then on the other side, you have Stanford, which had been so long without a national championship. They were 9 weeks on the road because of COVID protocols in their home county in Santa Clara. So they were also a sentimental favorite. Which one was going to win? How was this going to end? And to see the way that it did for Arizona, your heart broke for them. But for Stanford, you felt so good for the journey that team has been on, but also the incredible legacy and career of their coach, Tara Vanderveer.
Well, yeah, I mean, she was there the last time Stanford won a title in 1992, and of course she was on the floor last night. Give us more of a sense of what that journey was like to get her team to this point.
Stanford is based in Santa Clara County, and in late November, county officials decided they were going to put in very strict guidelines and protocols for what was going to happen because of rising COVID cases. Stanford could no longer play their home games at home, so they became nomads for 9 weeks. And at one point, Tara Vanderveer wondered, how are we going to do this? How are we going to finish up doing this? It was such a strain on the coaching staff and the players and everybody associated with that program. But once they got the clear to return back to campus and have their home games at Stanford in early February, they started to see a light at the end of the tunnel. It wasn't easy. They still had to be in their bubble. They still couldn't see their friends and family, but they knew what it was all for, and that was a chance to play for a national championship.
All the more amazing because in sports, there's no place like home. It's tough to be on the road for that long, and that is an understatement for sure. Let's move over to the men's. Tonight, Baylor is going to face off against Gonzaga. Let's start with the Final Four matchup, Gonzaga against UCLA over the weekend. There was this incredible overtime 40-foot buzzer beater from Gonzaga's Jalen Suggs. Let's listen to that.
back, ties it with three. Gonzaga has time to do something. Sox for the win.
People are going to be remembering that shot for a very, very long time. All the more dramatic because it saved Gonzaga's season. They are on a cusp of a perfect season, one game left to win.
As much as your heart broke for Arizona in the women's championship, your heart broke for UCLA in that semifinal game because also nobody expected them to be there. Nobody really thought that they were going to give Gonzaga much of a fight, and they were there till the very end. And you're thinking, wow, this game's about to go into double overtime, but the miracle shot goes in. So a remarkable performance by both of those teams. And now I think the question everybody's wondering is whether the championship game is going to be able to live up to the same hype that we saw out of UCLA Gonzaga.
I'm thinking the same thing. If you are Baylor right now, what is going through your mind? How are they going to approach this game?
I think Baylor has to be feeling really confident because of what they did in their semifinal game against Houston. They dominated from start to finish. That was as complete a game as we've seen in the tournament. And Baylor was playing like the best team in the country midway through until they had to take a pause because of COVID issues themselves. This is the matchup everybody wanted to see. Baylor, Gonzaga, these were the two best teams throughout the course of the season. So now we're going to get to see it. And if you're Baylor, you're feeling good about what you're able to do on offense, the way that you played in the semifinal, but also you're wondering whether Gonzaga is so emotionally tired because of what happened at the end of that UCLA game, whether they can get up for this type of a game. I'm sure they'll be able to, but if I'm Baylor and I'm their coach, that's what I'm hammering home to my players. They've already played a game of a century. Now it's up to us to finish it so that we can be declared national champions and we can win this game.
You know, for sports fans around the country who are watching these tournaments, it's got to be good for the soul after a long year of pandemic. No March Madness. Last year, of course, it was canceled. This has been an amazing run here. Andrea Adelson, senior writer at ESPN, thank you very much for your time. I'm sure you'll be holding your breath tonight, too.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter Rodell.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now.